Welcome to the Student Athlete Preparation Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster, the industry's leading sports technology and coach education platform. Check out their products and their coaching blog at Simply Faster. That's SimplyFaster.com. Today, I get the honor of chopping it up with strength and pitching coach and owner of Rogers Performance, Kyle Rogers. Countdown.
Welcome to the Student Athlete Preparation Podcast, hosted by high school strength and conditioning coach, Cody Hughes. This ain't your normal podcast, y'all. He's bringing real discussions about real strategies to improve the student athlete development and preparation process. New episodes every Friday with guests who are all about keeping it real. It'll warn you now. You might get your feelings hurt. The mics are on and the takes are hot. Enjoy this episode. Here's your host, Cody Hughes.
Kyle, what's good, my man?
What's up, man? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, dude. Couldn't wait to have you on, man. We've been talking a lot and getting a lot closer over the last year or so, and really wanted to hit the baseball market with you, man. I think that a lot of people really need to hear what you got to say. And I remember following you back because, you know, Kyle and I met on Twitter. So I remember following you when Driveline was all the buzz, right? Like, it was a big deal. Like, I remember getting introduced to Driveline in college when I had some teammates go up and do this weighted ball crap, and everybody was like, dude, what are you doing? You know, and saw you on Twitter and saw in your bio, like, I'm the lead strength trainer at Driveline. And I was like, oh, man, dude must know what he's talking about. So welcome to the show, man. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks again. Yeah, it's funny you say that. I have a free agent right now that's training with me that went to Oregon State and played against Trevor Bauer when he was at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, man, we used to make fun of him for, you know, the shoulder tube and the weighted balls and the long tops. And he's like, man, I'm doing everything right now that I used to make fun of.
It's funny how that happens, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kyle's he's a very unique because he's not just a strength coach. He does both. He's a strength coordinator and does pitching, throwing programs, throwing program design, all intertwined, man. He's got a really cool approach on how he does things, based out of Washington State, up in the Northwest, basically on opposite corners of the country talking right now. But Kyle, give us a little bit of background just shortly of, you know, how you got into baseball and where you've been and how you've gotten where you're at now.
Yeah. So I played college baseball. I played junior college baseball up here. Actually, the first school I went to, I got cut from, but ended up transferring to another junior college, dropped down to sidearm, and ended up playing 4 years college baseball, ended at a Division II school in North Carolina called Belmont Abbey College. And I was kind of like your prototypical guy of, like, you know, doesn't throw hard and knows how to pitch, blah, blah, blah. But I was like always trying to figure out how to throw harder. And so that's kind of what led me down my pursuit or interest of kind of performance training. And so when I graduated, I actually graduated with a degree in sport management, not exercise science, kinesiology, or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I took a part-time job training pitchers at a facility that I used to train at when I was playing, and ended up turning that into a full-time gig, doing creating a strength and conditioning program within that, doing the pitching stuff with it. And then eventually that led me to getting a job at Driveline. Like you said, started there as kind of a hybrid trainer. I'd spend the first half of my day on the throwing floor and the second half in the weight room. I think just kind of based on interest, I transitioned a little bit more into the weight room, became the lead strength trainer there, spent a year, at Cal State Northridge as the director of athletic performance under Bob Alejo. And then, college setting just kind of wasn't really for me. Plus wife wasn't a big fan of LA. So
I'm sure
came back home to Washington. And, you know, now I'm kind of running my own show. Like you said, I have, my Rogers Performance, which kind of started out just as like a remote training, business for a lot of like minor league baseball players to do remote programming over the off season, just kind of evolved over time into having the market to train people in person. So now we're just, you know, kind of going full send on that and training guys in person, training guys remotely.
Awesome. Talk to me a little bit about, cause you know, as we both know where Driveline has gone today and how it's been pretty groundbreaking for the most part. It was almost like taboo at one point to do anything thinking outside the box. What about your experience there? Did you feel like you learned as far as performance training goes? We've had this conversation before, I think, about what you think transfers and whatnot, because you had some cool resources there to like to run biomechanics reports. You had a biomechanics lab. You got to find some real answers that a lot of strength coaches or any coach period doesn't have access to. Like what did you find out there that kind of surprised you?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, like, I guess the most general thing to say is like, we kind of took the approach that like, we don't know anything. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I think especially in strength and conditioning, there's all these like preconceived ideas of like what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so, like you said, we had the resources, we had a full biomechanics lab, we had velocity, or we had tendos for velocity-based training. So we had all these resources and an entire research and development department that like would run this stuff for us. So, mm-hmm. you know, we had a quantitative analyst that I could just say, hey, I'm trying to see if there's any relationship between this, this, and this, and he would run it for me.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think like kind of just going back to like, we don't know anything. Like I went into Driveline with the idea that bench press was bad for baseball players. And like mm-hmm. anybody who knows me or follows me now knows that my view on that has drastically changed. And a big part of that is I had our quantitative analyst run a report on basically all of the metrics from our biomechanics report for the pitching with all of the metrics from our strength and conditioning assessment. So that's all of our range of motion measurements. Our strength testing was all like VBT based. So like we would do three different weights, kind of a lightweight, a moderate weight, and a heavy ish weight. To kind of build like a force velocity profile somewhat. But then B, just kind of see like if a guy was strong enough to go into like a velocity development program, like mm-hmm. weighted ball throwing. And so basically I had him run all of those metrics, see if there's any relationship. And like, I think my strongest correlation was like just under 0.4. Mm-hmm. So like I went down this like deep spiral of like, oh my God, the weight room doesn't matter. Like,
yeah.
Like nothing correlates with any sort of metric. Like we think about, you know, like, oh, like a lead leg brace, like the lead leg extending out. Oh, a squat or a deadlift has to correlate with that. Especially if we're talking velocity-based training where we're like training fast movements, nothing. But the one correlation we did have that was like somewhat strong was bench press, bar speed, and pitch speed. So it wasn't any sort of like metric of like internal rotation, angular velocity of the shoulder or anything like that. But it was just like, hey, like, the guys who threw the hardest also benched the best. So that's where I kind of went down that rabbit hole of like, all right, like maybe there's something to this. Like mm-hmm. when I got to Driveline, they were very like meat and potatoes in their strength and conditioning program. It was like, they had like four main movements. It was like front squat, bench press, RDL, and pull-ups. And it was just like, they just did that over and over.
Right.
And which was like drastically different than what I had done leading up to going there because I was like a big follower of Eric Cressy. And mm-hmm. so I wanted to like kind of adopt his same training principles. And so, you know, at the time, like, well, I mean, he still kind of is, you know, like the godfather of baseball training.
Yep.
You know, he trains the best guys in the sport. Like at the time, Corey Kluber was Cy Young Award winner. Like he trained Max Scherzer. So it's like, all right, he's training the best of the best. Like, how do I get to that level? But they just approach things so much differently at Driveline. And so I honestly think it was like a really good fit, because it forced me to kind of change my mindset. Mm-hmm. And I also think that my approach forced them to change their mindset a little bit. Yeah. And kind of meet in the middle and kind of collaborate a little bit better. So we could train athletes a little bit better that way.
Nice. That's sounded like, I mean, an invaluable experience, you know, of being able to see things and open your mind and make you really think, because that's the hardest part, is when you don't have something, if you're not in a situation that can echo to you, whether you're in whether things are working or not, or you get something objectively and you're finally like, I don't know. To me, when I see coaches answering things like, I'm not totally sure, but that tells me they're in a good spot. You know, like they're trying to see things objectively, not trying to see things with bias. And it's the coaches that don't have those resources to kind of give you that feedback, or coaches don't know where to look for feedback, and they get caught in an echo chamber, and they all of a sudden start chasing these red herrings of like, I know that what we do works because we win. And we're like, you know, or that's really tough to argue with somebody if they're really successful, you know. And then, so I'm sure that was really invaluable in your experience. So hit real quick on when you made the switch to, you know, college athletics and team setting, what did you take away from there into where you're at now? Maybe it's something that just from that college team experience, maybe you didn't see, or something you would tell other coaches that the difference between training where you're at now and training a team setting, how the team setting situation needs to be structured in order to be successful, right? Because it sounds like when you were down there, you were handling a lot. You know, you were the director of the department, and there's multiple teams you're running, and you're constantly running sessions, and sometimes it feels like you can't breathe. You know, sometimes you feel like you're just trying to survive. So I want to hear just a couple of key takeaways from CSUN at Northridge that you've taken with you.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is like, and I'm sure we'll touch on this a little bit later as well, but like creating systems. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we'll touch on this later, but I've gone back on that a little bit, but creating systems, because I found that like a lot of the stuff that I did at Driveline, where we did like 100% individualized programming, was just not really like feasible at the college setting.
Right.
You know, like when I'm with the baseball team, you know, we split pitchers and position players up. So, but I'm still dealing with like one of me and 20 of them. Mm-hmm. So creating a system to where I can give them all relatively the same program, but still kind of meet their needs that, you know, each individual needs. Mm-hmm. I think is like kind of the broader answer. And then as far as like where I think like the college setting needs to go, is like, it needs to be more integrated. And like, I will say like, so at CSUN, they hired Bob to be there. He's essentially their athletic director for performance. So he mm-hmm. oversees athletic training, strength and conditioning, and nutrition. And his big reason for doing that was that, you know, you have athletic directors or sport coaches who don't know a whole lot about strength and conditioning hiring strength coaches.
Right.
And so, like you said, it goes back to like, you know, a strength coach may come in and be like, oh, you know, I'm part of a winning culture. I won a lot where I was at before, where like you and I both know that like winning is not a great measure of like good strength and conditioning.
Right.
And so while I think that's a good thing that like somebody like Bob has taken that role to like make sure that somebody qualified is hiring these people, I wish that more of the sport coaches would have been involved in my hiring process. So that I would have known how, I guess, like the best word to use is like compatible we were, mm-hmm. Or like, I guess more so like what they wanted to get out of me.
Yeah.
Because, and like talking with a lot of other college strength coaches, like it's very, very much similar in their situation. Is like, there's just no real integration. It's like, hey, like you handle the weight room. We're going to handle the skill side of things. And, you know, like, you set the tone for the culture in the weight room. And it's like, no, that's stupid. Like, you're the head coach of this program. you set the tone for the culture.
Right.
And then let's get together and let's figure out how we can best develop these athletes. But instead, it's two separate entities. It's strength and conditioning. It's sport. And so there just needs to be a better way to integrate. And like you said, like, you know, I had, I think CSUN has like 19 varsity sports. And so basically the way that it worked with me was my assistant would be my assistant for the sports that I owned. And then we would kind of switch roles, and all the teams that he owned, I would be his assistant. So I was basically on the floor coaching all day. But like, I still think I could have done a much better job had we integrated more.
Sure.
You know, and like, so I think like broader is like create systems, because like a lot of things that people are doing in the private sector, like just looking at social media and seeing the things that people post, that, you know, you're using bands and slide boards and different tempos and, you know, different sled push pull exercises, like that stuff's not feasible in a team setting. Like, A, you just don't have the equipment to do it, but B, it just, it's a nightmare to go through in your head on how that's going to flow through your weight room.
Yeah. That's a big deal when it comes to programming and buying equipment. And like a great example of that is I've had coaches and players come up to me and be like, "Coach, how come you don't have a Vertimax?" You know, like a Vertimax is like the real deal, man. That's how you get verticals up. And I was like, let's talk about this, right? Vertimax costs what? $3,000, $2,500. One person can use it at a time, maybe two. Takes up a footprint in our weight room, and all it is just loaded movement. And we can recreate that at our racks with something else. It's right. Not as special as you think it is when you understand the principles of what it's training, right? It just looks really shiny for those of you that can't see the forest for the trees. Right. Like you can't see it. So that's a great point. That's a huge difference. And you know what I think would solve the problem, Kyle, is if, and people think this is, people will think this is backwards. I think that every single sports staff should have a strength coach and that the head coach should hire it. And people think I'm crazy that, oh, well, head coaches don't understand. I'm like, well, they have to hire the rest of their staff too. Right. They have to hire their pitching coach. And guess what? You can't just see pitching stats and see if they pitched well or not. You know, your pitchers could pitch really well and your defense is terrible or your offensive numbers are so bad. It's like trying to look at Jacob DeGrom's number and call him not a great pitcher because he doesn't have many wins.
Right.
You're at, because you don't understand what you're looking at. And I think if coaches, if every single staff at a college level would have their own strength coach and they were integrated, part of the staff were involved in recruiting, involved in practice design, involved in individuals in the fall, and really work together to communicate. That's how you, but I know that's probably not possible. So the next step is, you know, allocating who goes where to what sport and then trying to create systems and create relationships with those staffs. That, I mean, right. That's how I've always seen success anywhere I've been. When I've had a head coach that has been all about it, like all about it. So a couple that stick out to me is, one here, our football team is 100% bought in. Our head coach gets it. He includes me on everything, which is huge. Our baseball coach does as well. When I was at McNeese State, Justin Hill, he's the head coach at McNeese State. They just won the conference championship for the second time in a row. They're down in Louisiana, and they just played in the TCU regional. He's another guy that can really good, and he understands and can speak the language and included me on things. And you avoid things like you try to have a great day in the weight room and you want to blow up buys and tries on a Friday when it feels good, but you have guys throwing inter-squad innings the next day. Probably not the smartest thing, right? You can avoid those things if you're integrated, but a lot of times that gets missed because it's so separated. Like, hey, you handle the, they'll go to their strength sessions, and it's almost like we're a subcontractor.
Right. Well, like I see what you're saying too, but I think workload management is obviously important.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the smallest pieces to integration that there is. And that's what everybody talks about because it's the easiest part of integration to do. Like it's easy for the pitching coach to say, hey, we got a 9-inning inter squad tomorrow. You know, so-and-so is throwing. Mm-hmm. make sure they're fresh for that. And then, oh, those guys aren't doing buys and tries. They're not blowing those up. But it's like, that's literally like the most elementary version of integration that there is.
Right. It's a text. It's a phone call.
Right.
Right. It's an email.
That's just that's communication. Right. Like, that's not integration.
Yeah, that's true. I see what you mean on that. And so moving away from that, as far as training approach, and you and I this will probably be what we talk about majority of this episode. And so you and I, when quarantine happened, we decided to both dive in on a course with a company called Prescript. If you guys don't know who they are, this is not a paid ad for Prescript, I promise. Pre-script.com, led by Dr. Jordan Shallow, Dr. Jordan Genta, also heavily involved is Killian Hamilton. These guys, the two guys are chiropractors, powerlifters, and strength coaches. And to me, they opened our eyes on how the body functions. They talk about the difference between, especially with groups and how the body functions versus just moving, like how a muscle moves from origin to insertion. And it opened our eyes a lot. And I want us to just discuss kind of our experience with their Prescript level one course. And we can both talk about like what we got out of it and how we are using it in our training philosophy and our approach today. Because to me, it was it was pretty groundbreaking for me. Because, I mean, to be honest, I understood anatomy enough, but that course opened up functional anatomy. And when you say functional, the way they define it is how your body moves when you walk and breathe, right? And understanding how the body's going to move under certain circumstances, and then how that applies to demand in sport. So tell me, like, your experience, and we'll just kind of go back and forth and discuss why that course was so good for us.
Yeah, I think I'll provide a little bit of background of kind of how I got into them, I guess.
Yeah.
So I've always been a fan of the RX Radio podcast, which is their podcast, Dr. Jordan Shallow and Dr. Jordan Junta. And so one day I was listening to it, and God, I want to remember what the name of the podcast was, because it was like, oh, it was Low Back Pain and Leadership was the name of the podcast episode. And so I had been dealing with some like L5, S1 issues for probably the better part of like 3 years. And so I listened to this podcast, and listening to like the way that Shallow would like talk about the symptoms of the low back, or talk about like other symptoms that would like lead to symptoms of the low back. And then talking about listening to the way that he talked about like the anatomy and the functional anatomy of the spine and, mm-hmm. and like everything there, I was like, I gotta reach out to these guys. Like I gotta figure out what's going on with my back. Because I have been through, I've seen PTs who prescribe like, we're going to do these PRI breathing exercises. And it's like, oh my God, how many times can I do these breathing exercises to where it's just like, we're like, hey, like this ain't it. Like, yeah. This is not the answer. Or like, oh, your core is weak. So like, we need to hit some bugs.
some dead bugs
and bird dogs. And
so that's going to help you deadlift 365, right?
Right. So I happened to be listening to another podcast episode with Killian about skill acquisition. And so I posted, like I screen recorded and shared the podcast to my Instagram story, mm-hmm. and Killian shared it and followed me and like just DM me and was like, hey man, like, thanks for the share. And so I got to talking with him, and I'm like, hey, I got this issue going on. Can you help me with it? And so I set up a consultation call with him. And no joke, like just, I took a video of me deadlifting 135. Like that was it. A video of me deadlifting 135. And then a couple like single leg RDL, single leg RDL to hip airplane. And we hopped on a Zoom call, and he like told me everything he thought was wrong with that was causing my back issues. Wrote me a program for a month. After that month, like, I'm not kidding you, I couldn't RDL 135 without symptoms in my low back.
Wow.
And like within a month or two, I was deadlifting like 225 for like eights, like sixes or eights or something like that.
No pain?
No pain at all.
Wow.
And so that was when I was like, all right, I got to do this course. I got to see what all this is about. Like,
right.
I need to be able to speak in a way that they speak. And I need to be able to help my athletes the way that he just helped me so that, you know, I mean, low back pain is a very common issue in baseball because of all the rotation. So it's like, I'm going to come across hundreds of athletes who have similar symptoms as me. And I need to be able to help them the way that he just helped me.
Yep.
So that was kind of what got me into that course. And I would say the biggest thing, like I said earlier, like I have a degree in sport management, so I don't have the background of like anatomy, or anything like that. So that was huge for me, was not only like, I feel like you can do an anatomy class and like learn like what, you know, what muscles, what, and what that muscle does. And like you said, how it moves from origin to insertion, but like the way that they would talk about it in an applicable set, like way, like was just really, really crucial for me. And really what it did was it kind of just helped give me a why behind some things that I was already doing.
Right.
But another big thing was like, and this is, I guess, not necessarily from the prescript level one course, but kind of just from interacting with those guys, taking the course, talking to Killian, is like the skill versus output argument.
Yeah. Or
not really argument, but just like the skill
the
versus
concept.
Output
yeah.
concept.
This is huge. This is one we really wanted to get to, you know, and I really wanted to talk about this. So like, yeah, especially high school coaches that are listening to this. I want you to really peel your ears here and listen to what Kyle's going to say. And we're going to talk about this because this was groundbreaking to me, not necessarily the course itself, but this skill versus output approach, along with understanding how the body moves, changed everything for me, at least. So go ahead.
Yeah. So, I think like, we'll just talk about like the back squat, right? Like that's probably like the movement or the exercise that like, a lot of strength coaches think is king.
Mm-hmm.
Like that is like our program is built around the barbell back squat. And just hearing how Shallow would talk about like the different components that make up a back squat. And like Killian said it too, like the back squat doesn't build function. It expresses function.
Yep.
So
break that down a little bit. Let's talk about what that means, especially between building function and expressing function. Cause if you're good at the back squat, you're just expressing that things are going well. Right.
Right.
And it's a decently high skilled movement. Right. And it'll expose where maybe you're not functioning well,
right.
But you're not developing functional skills in the movement itself.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess, so we need to stabilize the pelvis during the back squat. So as we go down, we want to go into a little bit of posterior pelvic tilt.
Right.
And so to do that, we need the glutes to fully lengthen and basically maintain that posterior pelvic tilt. Well, a lot of people don't have the pelvic stability to maintain that on the eccentric and concentric. A lot of guys will, as soon as they start going into that concentric movement, will go into anterior pelvic tilt, which now we're turning the adductors into the prime mover instead of the glutes. And that's why a lot of people's adductors get super tight after they back squat, because they don't have the pelvic stability to express the function of the glutes in a back squat. And so basically what that means is that now your pelvic stability is a limiting factor in the amount of output you can drive in a back squat. So, eventually you'll reach a point of like technical fatigue or technical failure, and you're limiting the amount of output you can train. Whereas let's say you go to a leg press where you have this external stability of the machine. So I guess, let me back up. I'll explain kind of internal versus external stability.
Mm-hmm.
So internal stability is going to be like stability that you have to create within your body. So like internal stability on a back squat means that I have to keep my core braced. I have to maintain that pelvic stability with my glutes.
I think that the term functional comes along a lot with that too. Like, it's almost like people think functional means you like the word functional. You hear people don't like that term. You know, people throw that term around now. You know, Mike, it's a big Mike Boyle term, but being able to create internal stability and movement is almost a definition of functional. But that doesn't mean that external stability or exercises that give external stability aren't good, right?
Right.
So I'm just kind of adding to that as you go through defining these two terms.
Yeah, and I think like, I guess backtracking a little bit, like early on in my career, I would have thought like, oh, like machines are pointless. They're eyewash, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I thought the same thing.
The athlete doesn't have to stabilize themselves. So, you know, we're not improving their athletic performance. But in terms of just purely driving output, if we can find something that has an external source of stability, which like most high school weight rooms or most college weight rooms don't have that. Mm-hmm. So I'll get into a little bit of how you can kind of modify for that, I guess, in a yep. second. But external stability, right, is the machine. The machine is supplying the stability. On a leg press, we don't have to brace our core, or we maybe have to kind of make sure our pelvis is going into posterior tilt. But like, really the machine and the way the machine is set up is taking care of that for you. And so like, if we want to get into like just purely output or like force development, like what can we load more, a leg press or a back squat, especially if we're talking like intermediate, like novice athlete, like high school, early college athlete, they're going to be able to squat more or leg press more.
Yeah. Leg press, not even close. Right.
You're going to be able to add weight quicker on a leg press or a back squat?
Leg press immediately.
So we can practice the skill of squatting, but as soon as we hit that technical failure, we can go to something like a leg press. We can go to something like a belt squat where there's very little skill required. We have an external source of stability and we can just drive output there, especially with like a novice athlete that like is not very physically developed. Mm-hmm. Now, if we want to get into like professional athletes or like advanced elite college athletes, like they might be a little bit more proficient in something like a back squat or a deadlift or something like that, where we can actually drive output there. But yeah, I'll kind of backtrack a little bit. So like I said, not a lot of college or high school weight rooms have, like a leg press or even really a belt squat. Mm-hmm. So like my biggest go-to is the landmine.
Yep.
Because there's a fixed point on the landmine. That's your external stability. And so, yeah, you're going to have to create a little tiny bit. Like, let's say we're doing like a landmine, like goblet squat or something, or like a landmine RDL or landmine row. We got to create a little bit of internal stability in our setup, but that fixed point provides a lot of external stability that something like a dumbbell or a barbell freestanding, not in a landmine, won't.
Yeah. See, it's such a good point because I want coaches to understand when you're trying to set up a progressive system of how you lead young athletes, especially like eighth grade into high school, right? And this is what I deal with, is that the first thing you've got to do is you have to start teaching and developing skills. Like, there's not, when you're that age anyway, you're not going to be able to create a ton of output, right? Because you're that young. And you're definitely not going to create output in something like a back squat where there is a lot of pieces going on in order to even get to output area. And when we say output, that means that we are giving the body a stimulus where it has to physically and even neurologically adapt. Like, it has to adapt in the horsepower area, right? You need to be able to create force. We need to be able to put on size, right? It's metabolically challenging to the body to where it adapts. If you're trying to train the back squat and it's not very good and the skill's not very high and you try to push the load to where you get that adaptation, either one, they're not going to be able to do it because they're not skilled enough to complete the rep, or two, they're going to get hurt because they're not skilled enough to hold internal stability without the load literally leveraging the body into bad positions where it's not stable. And that's when injury happens, right? The definition of injury that we literally took this, I took this term from Jordan Shallow and RX Radio, is for applied force is greater than tissue tolerance. That's where injury happens. And if your skill level is not high, that's when injuries start happening, right? But also, again, that doesn't mean that you have to treat your kids like they're, you know, pieces of glass, and or treat your athletes like, oh, we have to go to the PVC pipe and we're only on the PVC pipe. They see that's where they where I'm missing the boat. Like, I see that either coaches are pushing weight that they shouldn't be pushing and just jump straight to a really high skilled movement like a clean or a back squat, or they go to the they goblet squat for 2 years and don't ever get off a PVC pipe, which I think are both wrong, right?
Right.
What is something, what's an easy cherry picked exercise we can take to output immediately? First one is trap bar deadlift. I really believe it. It's not that hard to teach. Now, is there some learning curves you need to go over? Sure. Like you have to have a little bit of pelvic stability. You have to learn how to engage the lats, but the best way to learn how to do it first is just lower the range of motion, you know, like make the range of motion less, make sure you're pulling a little bit higher. Maybe learn my first progression of anything we do, period, in our eighth grade group, which is the first time they see me, is learning to pick a barbell off of blocks, or like a rack pull that some people would call it, where it's getting into a hinge position, learning how to brace and just picking it up properly and putting it back down. And then maybe we can get to a point where the trap bar is where we can start pushing output. Then you got all the accessory works that you can push output with. You can push output with rows if you can set up right. Chin-ups is usually an easy one if you can learn how to sequence pulling and pushing correctly, right? That's one that a lot of coaches don't teach, is that like the bench press doesn't need a lot of teaching. Yeah, bull crap. Yes, it does. Like, you need to teach how to set up. You need to teach how to leverage. You need to teach how to get the lats engaged to where you're not having so much pressure on the anterior side of the shoulder, right? You need to teach leg drive so you can produce more force. A lot of things that I don't see high school coaches teaching on a chin up, right? I see a lot of times they get to the top and they're reaching with their chin, right? And then their front of their shoulder's dumping, right? Instead of taking their chest to the bar and allowing their lats to, and scaps to actually depress, right? And understanding the mechanics of that before you ever drive output. Like, can you do one chin up correctly before we try to burn out? Like, how many coaches are like, oh, we're going to just roll on chin ups. I'm like, you're not there yet. Right. And then, but you can synergistically program to, all right, we've got some skills we need to work on, and we've got some outputs that we can go to, right? Killian, you know, you and I both hired Killian to train us each at one point, and just to learn. And I have a really bad hip problem, and he was helping me with some hip issues that I was having. And like, he was showing me how, like, we're going to start off with a split squat and go really tempo to try to increase stability, because that's really skill driven. You need to be fresh neurologically to be able to do that. And then we'll move to, you know, a goblet squat and a leg press towards the end, so we can actually get some adaptation in the tissue that's not as much neurologically demanding, right? And just that piece right there, and that ordering of understanding how to practice skill and then ease to output at the end of the session, that in itself is, I'm carrying that in my training today.
Yeah, I think you hit on a really important point, and like something that I've really started to do with my programming is like separating like exercises or drills based on the type of stimulus.
Yep.
So like, is it a neurological stimulus or is it a physiological stimulus? Mm-hmm. Is it a blend of both of those? And so like, that's what Killian talks about with like the skill acquisition model, right?
Is
cognitive, associative, and autonomous. Like, cognitive is going to be all of your physiological things, like highly skilled movements that aren't going to tax you physiological at all. Associative, which is a blend of both. So that's where like, we're talking like back squat or split squat, something that, you know, we're going to load up, but it's also going to require some skill, and you're going to eventually hit like a technical failure in it. And then your autonomous, which is just all physiological, which is what we're talking about, output with like something like a leg press. Like, if you fail a leg press, you're not going to fail it because your technique.
Yep.
You're going to fail it because literally the weight got too heavy for you to push up.
Yeah.
And like, that's what you want. You've reached that physiological fatigue. And so like you're talking about with like high school programs where guys stick with the PVC pipe too long, or like a goblet squat or a counterbalance plate squat, something that I'm really starting to, now that I've, you know, I've gone to the college setting, I've worked with a lot of professional athletes, and now, you know, I have a decent size of high school athletes. It's like the one thing that's really difficult to gauge with a high school athlete is how hard a workout is. Because they don't have any skills. And so like something like a squat or a split squat or a bench press, they're not going to be able to do very much weight. And so I think the important thing to understand is like, you know, we talk about like sensation over stimulation, where like people chase this like feeling instead of actually choosing the exercise that's going to actually stimulate them. Is like, if you don't stimulate your athletes some way with some sort of physiological output, they're going to go to the gym later and they're going to choose sensation over stimulation.
Yep.
They're going to go crush arms with terrible technique. They're going to go bench till failure with terrible technique. And like, then like, that's where injuries happen too. And that's not under your watch. And that's something that you can control with intelligent progression in the weight room.
Yep.
With, like you said, three movements: split squat, goblet squat, leg press. We go from most skilled to least skilled. We can drive output on the leg press. You left feeling beat, right? Like you reach physiological fatigue.
Yep.
You didn't feel the need to go work out again later. And so I think that's where like a lot of people make mistakes, is like, oh man, like my kids can't do anything because they don't have very good technique. And so you spend 30 minutes on a PVC pipe and you do a counterbalance plate squat and you do a push-up eccentric, but then they leave and they didn't get any physiological stimulus.
Yeah. That's important. And that brings us to this point. Exercise selection is 100% important. Like, do not think that exercise selection is just, oh, I'm just chasing a stimulus. I'm just chasing a, you know, it doesn't matter what you pick. It can be, you know, it's a squat, a hinge, a push, a pull, a carry. I'm tired of hearing that. I really am. It pisses me off because it's not that freaking simple. Like, it's so much deeper than that, right? Like, cause to me, that's not how sports played. Like, you don't just break down basketball as shoot, dribble, shuffle, run, jump, do you? Of course not. Right. It's deeper than that. Like, it's way deeper than that. So when it comes to exercise selection, like, for example, we're going to take baseball, for example, being in gate stance is super important in baseball because of the demand of the sport. So it can't just be, oh, we're just going to do unilateral exercises. It's okay. That's like the very like vaguest thing you can say. All right. Now, what are you doing like kinematic wise and sequence wise that makes sense in the game of baseball, right? Like, can you rotate your hips on a fixed femur, right? Can you internally and externally rotate on a fixed femur? Because that's what's happening, right? You can't just do internal and external rotation, you know, standing up like this and think it's just going to transfer. You can't just do a barbell split squat and go down, up, down, up, down, up, and not enter some type of transverse, you know, unilaterally, ipsilaterally, contralaterally loaded stimulus, because that's what's happening on the field. You know what I mean? Like, that's what's happening when they play. So then you have to intelligently think about, well, where on the spectrum are these athletes at? Like, I've got an eighth grader and I've got an 11th grader. Like, where are they at as far as the skills they've built, and what do they need stimulus wise to continue to transfer to their play, to their skills on the field, right? Because that's where strength conditioning really needs to move, period. Is that guy, like, if you're not helping the athlete get better at their sport and you're just making them a better lifter, you're not that good of a strength coach for performance. You may be a decent coach in the weight room, and you know what, at the high school level, there's a caveat to that, because the whole other side of like, this kid just loves to train and wants to be around and wants to be a meathead. I'm not talking about that, right? That's a whole different conversation we can table for now. Like, if you just want to talk about building relationships with kids, don't think about that. We're talking about, how do we improve the performance of our kids? Because if we just squat, hinge, push, pull, carry, Like, do you really think that that right there in itself is as intelligent as we can get? Like that's all we do. Like we're that dumb. I don't think so. Like it's way deeper than that, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think it's twofold, right? Like if we're talking about baseball, it's a sport that's so highly skilled, right? Like, throwing a baseball, there's so much that goes into it. And like, I got an athlete training with me right now who, you know, we take slow-mo video of him throwing. He's literally one frame away from like being there. Like, and like, that's it. One frame could be the difference between 92 and 95. Could be the difference between not getting signed and getting signed. And he's been one frame away for a year. Yeah. And so like, it's such a highly skilled movement that we have to be very specific in what the stimulus is that we choose for them.
Right.
We can't just build the engine because this comes back to like the integrative piece, right? Like if I'm a pitching coach and I got a kid that, can't rotate on a fixed femur, can't properly load his back hip to promote an efficient pelvis rotation into foot plant. I can't continually cue this kid over and over the same things if that's a physical limitation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the strength coach comes in and says, hey, I got player with XYZ issue. This is what we're going to do to solve it. In the meantime, continue cueing him and let's see if we can't make any progress on this thing.
Yeah.
The way it's traditionally done is squat, hinge, push, pull, lunge. That's your weight room stuff. Pitching coach, cue, 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 bash my head into a wall. That's the pattern. That is the pattern of that. And it's not getting us anywhere. And so there has to be some sort of evaluation process where we're like, hey, you know, this kid's got XYZ issue, which could lead to XYZ issue on the field. And we're going to, you know, accomplish it by doing this. I think the other thing that we have to think about is if we just say, oh, baseball is played on one sport or one leg. So we're going to split squat. Well, now that comes back to our skill versus output, right? Because if we don't have the rotational stability in the hip to effectively do a split squat with a barbell on our back or in a front rack position or a safety squat bar, whatever it is, we can't drive output.
Nope.
And so now we have to peel it back a little bit and we have to go two main questions. One, what is the demand of the sport? Two, what is this athlete's deficiencies?
Yep.
And so I would say demand of the sport, if we're talking about pitching, we want to load a contralateral split squat so that we can drive some internal rotation so that we can rotate on that fixed femur during the leg lift.
For those of you that don't know what that means weight is in the opposite hand of the leg that's in front, just so you guys know.
Right. And so we can promote some internal rotation on both hips so that we can effectively rotate on a fixed femur, load that back hip, and also block and brace on our lead leg, which for those that don't know, the block is essentially where the lead leg lands, stops forward momentum, and then redirects the transfer of energy up the chain.
Yep.
As that lead leg braces out and propels the upper body forward. Now what's happening there is the pelvis should land at about 45 degrees open. And when that leg braces out, what happens is it finishes the pelvis rotation and actually ends up rotating the pelvis to about like probably like an average of like 110 degrees. So like you don't need a ton of internal rotation, but you do need control of that internal rotation.
Right.
So that's what we're talking about when we talk about like rotational stability on that hip. Now, as far as like what the athlete needs or where their deficiencies are. I guess I'll just kind of talk about how I determine that.
Yeah.
So the progression regression model that I've kind of taken from the Prescript Level 1 course is a bottoms up split squat to sprinter pose. So just starting in the bottom of a lunge position and then up into a sprinter pose, into a walking lunge to sprinter pose, into a single leg RDL to sprinter pose, into a single leg RDL with hip airplane. Essentially, the idea behind this is each time we progress the movement, we add a little bit of instability and we see how that athlete responds to the instability. And so basically you're going to look at the foot and the ankle, and the foot and the ankle is going to wobble each time you introduce some more instability. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is the foot is providing sensory feedback to what's going on at the hip. Mm-hmm. And now a lot of people see this, and this is another issue I see, is a lot of people see this and they're like, ah, that ankle's unstable. And if we're looking at,
you're looking at body, symptom, you're not looking at root.
Correct. And so like, if we look at like where a bulk of the musculature is in our body, it's in our midsection, mm-hmm. right? Like we want to work proximal to distal. And a lot of people spend a lot of time working distal to proximal because they're seeing the symptom and they're addressing the symptom.
Yep.
And so the foot wobbling is what's providing some sensory feedback to what's going on at the hip. Now, guys are either going to get pulled laterally or they're going to get pulled medially. And that will give you some insight as to kind of if they are more dominant in like an adduction internal rotation stance or an abduction external rotation stance. And then from there, you can kind of address what you need to address. So like, if a guy is more like internal rotation bias, you can start to ipsilaterally load a lot of his stuff, start to drive that early stance of the gait cycle where we're kind of in that like ipsilateral stance, that front leg is being loaded. We're having to resist abduction. We're in a little bit of external, or not resist abduction. We're in a little bit of abduction, external rotation. Whereas we go complete opposite with a guy who's external rotation, abduction biased, we start to go contralateral load where that front hip has to resist abduction, back hip goes into internal rotation, mimicking that late stance of gait cycle. And so that's kind of like, I guess we've kind of come full circle as to like the Prescript Level 1 course is like, you know, function is how we behave when we walk and breathe. Like we can take how we walk and we breathe and load that and get the stimulus we're looking for, create some rotational stability in the hip. And then we can go drive some output with a leg press afterwards. And now we've made them better at their sport and we've made them better just physically, athletically speaking, as far as like force output goes.
Yeah. We've made them efficient movers to be able to transfer force. Well, if you can bridge the gap into skill, being able to execute skill from that force application and how you move, now your potential to be able to execute that skill at a high level just increases. Like your ceiling is no longer low. And what I loved about that course is that it broke it down very simply into, you know, their mantra is mobility, stability, strength, and kind of in that order. And the three hubs of stability are shoulder, hip, and spine. And like you said, majority of our musculature is on the midline, right? It's in the center of our body. Those three hubs are where we need to look of what's going on. And that opened up, if you start there, you know, everything else will kind of take care of itself for the most part. And like, for example, you told me that part of the solving of your back problem was that you just weren't using your lats to take on a lot of that energy. You had no idea how to engage your lats to be able to take on that force in a hinge position. So it was escaping that and going straight to the spine, right?
Right. Yeah. Essentially the way that I really like the way that he said it was, I'll actually just paraphrase the podcast, was like, if you keep getting stabbed in the arm, like don't just keep putting a phone book on your arm.
Yeah, I remember that episode. Right? Like, yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, like people, if they have like low back issues, reverse hypers. Do 100 of them a day, your low back issues will go away. And it's like, again, you're training the symptom.
Yeah.
Right. So we're not actually solving any issue with that. And so basically we found that with my deadlift setup, my knees were super bowed out. I was externally rotated. And as I pulled up, once the bar passed my knees, I had this like super long moment arm, like I was almost going to clean it. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't engaging my lats and pulling the weight into my body as I came up. And so basically like everybody teaches like when you deadlift, like, hey, like, you know, scaps back, like pin the scaps, hold tight. And it's mm-hmm. like, no. Like that's going to engage like mid trap rhomboid.
Right.
We want lats, you know, like we want the lats, the biggest muscle in our upper body to be what stabilizes that spine. Like mm-hmm. the lat attaches to the pelvis. And so what's the lat's function? To depress the scap. And so we want to drive some scapular depression. So literally all I did was when I did RDLs, I would just let the weight of the bar pull me into depression and then try and squeeze my lats as hard as I could. And then obviously, you know, there were some other cues of like, hey, you know, when you get that bar past your knees, like drive your hips through, like right. try and, you know, get rid of that long moment arm. But, you know, it was like that one big piece of like, hey, like you're not using your lats. And so like what they would say is like your lats aren't checking the force at the door. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's essentially like you said, like applied force greater than tissue tolerance. All right. So lats aren't doing their job. Your glute meads, you're so externally rotated that you're just not getting
it has no medial leverage whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and you're getting no medial stability. And so your glute meads just saying, hey, adductors, you could take the day off. We got this. But eventually over time that fatigues out.
Yep.
And they're like, we can't do it anymore.
Not a juice.
And the adductors are like, we're on vacation, man. Not doing it either. And so now adductors aren't checking the force. Lats aren't checking the force. Glute med can't check the force anymore. Where's the force got to go? To the spine.
Yep.
And so like that's function right there. It's just like, hey, like these three things need to work together a little bit better.
Yeah.
Here's how we're going to do that.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, that hits the nail on the head of what function really is how like the bicep doesn't just, you know, go from being lengthened to shortened. It plays a role in the glenohumeral joint because of where it attaches. Right. And muscles aren't dumb. That's another thing that a lot of people think the muscles are stupid. The brain tells the muscles what to do. Well, not necessarily. They're a lot smarter than you think. And like, for example, training the bicep can have a really large role in shoulder health because of where it attaches at the shoulder. That's why it needs to not be unstable in multiple different positions. If you think about the bicep curl, like really the way that I check boxing symptoms now, I mean, in my system, a lot of S words we've been throwing out, but, in the system I use now when I'm training arms is making sure that I hit it in every plane, right? I hit it in flexion, I hit it in abduction, I hit it in extension, right? And then all of my rows are going to hit the mid range and I don't have to worry about that anymore because we're going to row like crazy. And at the same time, while we're rowing, like one huge thing that I see rows get butchered like crazy is that, you know, they try to see, all right, they think that dumbbell traveled in space means full range of motion because that's often what that means. And, and athletes will compensate by trying to make the dumbbell travel. And in order to get there, they don't know how to get there properly. And then that shoulder will internally rotate and dump. And now you're actually not getting any stimulus at the lat, right? Instead of teaching people to keep their elbow low, I love the cue, try to wrap your elbow around your body. Right. Mm-hmm. And then also tell kids, like, try to squeeze your tricep into your armpit. Right. And then you're going to feel that lat, your range of motion. You might not even get past 90 degrees in a lat, but I mean, in your elbow, like your elbow might not get past 90 degrees, but the activation and the force applied in your lat is greater than it's ever been. And I've had athletes, when I finally show them how to row correctly, they're like, oh my gosh, I was so sore the next day. I was like, I know, because you've never had that stimulus before.
Right.
You know, like, so.
Yeah. Most people are just going all rhomboid mid trap, just squeeze the scaps.
Yeah.
I'll use the cue like elbow down instead of elbow back. Cause like everybody's going to pull that elbow back.
Right.
And like I said, like pinch the scap, like go mid trap rhomboid. And like, there's a time and place for sure. But driving that elbow down is going to get us that like depression we talked about and get that lat going. And like you said, like the range of motion might be 90 degrees of elbow flexion. That's it. But it's like, and I've actually started to look at a lot of my like rowing movements where like my goal is pelvic stability out of them.
Yeah.
So it's like getting into a, like, I kind of have two different categories I'll go to for rowing movements. It's like, number one is, pelvic stability. So like getting them in a position where like the lat stabilizes in like an RDL or a deadlift. So holding that hinge position, you can go in a B stance position for that. So like drop one leg back. And now not only are we stabilizing in like a hinge position that we would be in an RDL or a deadlift, but now we're adding kind of a rotational stability component to it, because we're loading it unilaterally. Yep. So we can, again, we can do that either, ipsilaterally or contralaterally. And then my other one is, kind of goes back to the prescript course where like, hey, the function of the lat is to resist rotation.
Yep.
And so I'll go like a cable row where I set up a little bit offset with the cable and actually get a little bit of like T-spine rotation into it, force that lat to fully lengthen, shoulder fully protracts. And now I can kind of get some T-spine rotation and some anti-rotation out of my rowing movements.
Yeah, that's and exposing the body to these stimuli that are going to transfer to skill movements that they're trying to train for output on the field. Like when they pick up a baseball on the field, it's output. What they're only going to fall back on what their body knows how to move efficiently. It's either going to compensate or it's going to do it right. And that leads to one of two things. We can, if it's done right, you're going to probably throw it harder than you've ever thrown, right? You're not going to be as likely to get injured. Now, that's a whole different conversation because really hard throwers are so daggum powerful, it's hard not to get hurt. Like, that's a whole different conversation. It's not that, your mechanics and your function is perfect. You're now bulletproof. And I wish it was that easy. We'd be billionaires if we could just answer that question that easy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that's why I wanted to bring you on, Kyle. Coaches, I want you guys to understand that you can't just program blindly, and then you can't coach blindly, right? You can't just expect to tell a kid on a back squat of hips back, knees out, eyes up, and think that it's going to get the job done. If you want back squat to be part of it, you need to learn how to teach it, right? Just like with anything, like if you need to be a better coach. That's really the best way I know how to put it. And if you want everyone to have a conversation, man, hit me or him up, man. I will have a conversation about it in a heartbeat about what these things mean, right? Like what's happening in a back squat. Like when he says posterior pelvic tilt, keeping the rib cage stacked over the pelvis as you're going as into your descent in a back squat. Like, what does that mean? Like, why should you have your elbows placed in a specific position in the back squat? Right. A lot of people want the elbows to be really flared and out. Like you want them actually stacked underneath so your lats can function correctly in order to stabilize your pelvis in the first place. Right. Like people don't understand. I didn't understand until I took this course that the lat, if you look at it in an anatomy book, the lat is massive. It is huge. And then you look at it where it goes down and then understanding like where it connects with the thoracolumbar fascia, the Christmas tree, as bodybuilders like to call it. Right. Yeah. A lot of bodybuilders have. And when he showed us the video, I don't know if it was like or a picture of Dorian Yates and some other bodybuilder of like everybody's morphology, which is how you're built. Their lat doesn't attach at the same spot. Like some people, it's a little higher up. Some people, it's a little lower. Like we're not built the exact same way. So our leverages are different. Right. And how that relationship into the pelvis and how it helps resist rotation. Right. That's all function and functional anatomy that we have to understand as strength coaches that play a part into our programming and then how we coach things like and then where our priorities go. Now we can't just always be about how much weight we lift because that's not what's happening on the field.
You know?
And that's where you finally get answers of why does my best weight room guys not perform best on the field? Because they haven't acquired skill.
Right.
It's that simple. It's not easy. It's not. It's still. It's not. it's a simple concept, but it's really hard to develop. I mean, it's I'm not right. saying that it's easy. Simple and easy does not mean the same thing. Like, of understanding what happens. Like, you can look at it from like playing quarterback and then pitching. So like, if you're playing quarterback and you're a football coach, think about all the conceptual and psychological things have to happen in the quarterback's mind in order to make a decision before they even do anything physical. Then the sequencing of getting the ball out on time in the place they want with somebody trying to hit them, right? Those are all skills. Those are all skills that have to be trained over years. In pitching, it's the fastest motion in sport, right? How fast and how in time, like you said, one frame away, guy's been working on it for a year.
Yeah.
It's that hard. Like, in order to be elite, right? And that could be the difference between you sitting at home or getting a contract,
right?
So, and that's also why we have to not be jumping at flashy things that look good and understand the why behind things and why, like, sometimes boring is the best. Because, like I told my young guys today, like, we've been doing high pulls from block with my eighth graders for like 6 months. And they go, "Coach, when are we going to be able to move on?" I was like, until you literally can't get the sequence wrong. Until you can set up perfectly, till you can time it off your hips perfectly, right? Till you get it to the point where you can't get it wrong. So I'm setting you up so when we do move on, we have a chance at output now that's also skilled, right? We have that chance. If I don't give you that chance, well, I didn't do my job. You know what I mean? And that's how I feel. That's why it's so important to understand that exercise sequence and selection matters. The order in which you put it in matters. Where, how much bandwidth you have neurologically, you only have so much, right? And if you expend it poorly, you're not going to get a return. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you try to just burn your kids on a back squat where their skills aren't high, they're not getting the output that they could have gotten, so their legs aren't developing. Like, that's what's crazy is you see guys' bodies not change because you're either one, you're not applying right stimulus, or two, like, their skill's not good, so they're never even getting to the point to fatigue their legs. You know, like, how are we going to get strong? I had this conversation about the Zercher squat with Alan Bishop down in Houston. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the Zercher squat, but I found something out that I wasn't intending to find out. And I think you'll enjoy this, is that my original intention of the Zercher squat was to increase leverage to an extension of a goblet squat in an anterior position to where I can get my pelvis in a better position. I can get into deep knee flexion. I can also infinitely load it with a barbell to where I can load my legs and not have to worry about trying to get into a front rack position, right? But what I found out through running it, through experience, I just hung my hat on that and we did it, found out. What I found out was the limiting factor now was our erectors in our core. Guys' legs weren't really getting stressed, but what happened was is that their tension in their core and in their pelvic stability got way better. And then we turned and went to a box squat and our freaking numbers went off the roof because guys understood that they were a little more robust in their core. They were a little more robust and more stable in their pelvis, because when you lower the bar into that carried position, like, it's really easy to get posterior pelvic tilt of the hips because of the position of the bar in a Zercher squat.
Right.
So like, they feel that, like, we're training that. And plus our back, upper back and everything's on fire. And we got really good at transferring force because now we know how to put our pelvis underneath our rib cage. But if I didn't do that and just threw him into a back squat, it would do exactly as you said earlier. Posterior, oh, boom, anterior. We don't have any stability. Okay, that's our limiting factor in driving output. So that's why it was important. Like, I found that out, but I didn't think that's what it was. Like, I thought that I would be able to fatigue the legs and it'd be an immediate output exercise. Because you're not having to worry about holding it in a front rack and holding T-spine extension. Well, I found something out different than what I intended. Well, golly, guys, why can't we all do that? You know, you might find something out if you just try it. Like, don't be scared. Yeah. Like, stand on your own 2 feet and try something and be willing to be wrong. And just because you might not have found out what you wanted to find out, you might find something else that may be valuable.
Yeah. You thought you were training an output exercise and turned out you were training skill.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I was like, oh, wait, okay, now I can place this. And Alan told me, he was like, now I'm placing that based off our conversations into our first 3 week capacity in summer for our basketball guys, so we can build a little bit more of that skill and that robustness. So when we get to try to do our heavier squats and want to drive output in our legs, we have built a little more capacity and skill ready to roll in order to do that and ordering it correctly.
You know, that that brings up a really good point, and I'm sure we could go off on another tangent of this, but like the whole like GPP, SPP, SDP, all that stuff, like a lot of people when they go into like preseason or like off season where like skill volume's relatively low, guys will go into a GPP phase. Oh, we want to get them generally prepared, work on general stuff to get them generally strong. And then once they go into their skill work, we'll start to focus on more specific stuff. And it's like, you got that backwards.
Yep.
Your skill work is low. We're going to go high skill work in the weight room. That's our time where we can really, really tax the neurological or the nervous system there.
Mm-hmm. And you can build new skills in the weight room that you might not have the bandwidth to do that during when all your skill, all your cash, right? All your coins you have for skill, which because you only have so many, are allocated to practice.
Right. That's where you go to your toolbox and your weight room's all physiological.
Yeah.
We're very, very, very little neurological and mostly physiological. You know, now it's like, all right, we're going to do 1 to 3 sets of split squats, or we're going to do 1 to 3 sets of bench press, and we're going straight to the cable machines for flies, or we're going straight to the leg press or belt squat and driving physiological output there, because we don't have any neurological output left to give. It's all at practice.
Yep.
They just played 3 games last weekend.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that if you're smart and you pick the exercises and you order them correctly, which we've been talking about, so important, that you can do both. So you can do, like, when it comes to the GPP, I don't like GPP because I don't want to do anything general, period. I'm very specific in everything I do. You know what I mean? And that may be cherry picked. You can make fun of that. And you're like, oh, that's not what GPP means, man. You're taking it out of context, bro. Okay, maybe I am, but listen to what I'm saying. Like, you want to build skill to set yourself up for output later and things that are going to give you the highest return on investment. But at the same time, you can pair physiological output stuff at the end of the session in order to create some of that work capacity that you need. Because the way I look at it is that our kids need to have enough capacity to train for output in the first place. Because a lot of my young guys will gas out so fast. Like, I'm like, well, that's it. Go home. Like, that's it. Yep. Session's over. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, you have nothing left. And if we try to do something else, we're getting worse.
Right.
So we're not going to do that. Right. All right. So we can build skill early, try to train a little bit of capacity and low skill requisite movements towards the end of the session, and set ourselves up for when it's time to get super powerful and super strong. We have a foundation of movement and we have a foundation of fitness, skill specific fitness. That's a big thing. You know what I mean? Like, do you have the fitness within the skill that you want to do in order to execute, right? Like, just like in football, like, you got to have the fitness first to be able to execute on a 6 to 8 play drive. Because if you gas out and you're neurologically fried, period, you're not going to be able to execute any skills you learned anyway. So I believe fitness, skill specific fitness, is very important. In pitching, it's the same thing. Starter may throw 75 to 100 pitches, right? However many seconds he's going to throw, he may sit in the dugout for 5 minutes. He may sit in there 20 if you have a long inning, right? That's and you build that skill specific fitness in your throwing program. Like, you literally do that in your throwing program and progressing pitch counts, progressing volume and intensity, just like you would anywhere else. That's also where strength coaches can be of more value, if they can be involved in how things are designed overall and globally. Right. You heard Schles talk about it on the RX radio about how strength coaches can get involved in practice design if they can get involved in talent and recruitment at the highest level. Right. This guy can do this. This guy can do that. Finding measurables that fit your scheme and how you're successful. It's not just building the engine, man. Like, we're so much more valuable. Then head coaches will never want you to leave, because you're so much more valuable than just, hey, get our guys stronger, faster, bigger, you know, and we have to do a better job as strength coaches, period, in doing that. And a lot of that has to do with just being patient with your sport coaches, because sometimes they don't know what they don't know. And I'm very lucky. My football coach here really gets it. And he includes me on everything. Hey, what do you think? Like, he literally texted me the other night. He's like, hey, what do you think? Why do you think hamstring issues are happening in the NBA? And I said, because of the season turnover. Didn't have enough time to prepare. Went straight into a new season. We don't have the capacity to withstand the demand. He goes, I agree. Good. I thought that's what you'd say, because we've had these conversations, right? Yeah. And then we talk about, you know, Like we talk about, all right, hey, coach, what do you want to get done in the week? This is what we need to get done. What's our highest priority? Okay, we need to get these things done on the field. It's going to be this duration. Okay, where are we at in our season to be able to, like, we're actually working together on where we're going to allocate our energy and neurological coins or points or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So that's just not separate. So, like, because if you try to drain from both ends, you're going to burn the candle from both ends. And something, either you're not going to develop, worst part is if somebody's going to get hurt. Second, if you're not going to be able to maximize your time to be the best team and player you can be because you're draining, because now you're going to be okay at both. Like, you can't just, like, that's what happened at McNeese when I made that huge decision. Like, you can't push on one end, and they're also in the peak of trying to prepare and doing high inning inner squads, getting ready in the preseason to play. And I'm over here in the weight room acting like an idiot and taking away from that.
Right.
That's the value. And I don't know how we got on that topic. Maybe I just thought about it, but that's the value of the strength coach.
Yeah.
My opinion. So,
yeah, I agree 100%. And like you said, kind of like, you know, figuring out how our industry can get better is like, it's that.
Yeah.
And it, the hard part is it doesn't fall all on the strength coach,
yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah, very much so.
It's twofold. Like the sport coach has got to be on board too.
Yeah.
And so there's gotta be a way that sport coaches can, it's hard because ego is a big part of it, right? Like,
yeah.
Sport coaches don't want to feel like they need help from the strength coaches. Just like strength coaches don't like when sport coaches come in and tell them what exercises they want their teams to do. Yep. Right. Like,
yep.
It goes both ways. And so like, you know, then it becomes, okay, why do you want your guys to do these exercises? Can we talk through it and, you know, critically think about what exercises they should be doing versus what you want them to do. But then you run into the problem of like, you know, then your sport coaches feel like you're talking down to them.
Yeah.
Like you're trying to flex on them a little bit.
Yeah, you got to be skilled in that area, guys. You can't, it's not right. A good idea to come in and a head coach and try to flex with your physiological knowledge. It's just not smart.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way.
I did too. I mean, I've been there, but, and that's just a sign of youth and immaturity and insecurity of like, I need to prove my worth. So I'm going to do it intellectually rather than trying to earn trust. Like I've been there. Like I've totally been there. I'll admit to it. Like we've got to be better at that. And we got to be better at communicating, period.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, that like that integrative piece and like Schles says, like, you know, you have these sport coaches who don't have any background in anatomy, physiology, don't know anything about the nervous system, and they are in charge of the biggest neurological stressor in all these athletes' lives.
Yep.
And so how can we help?
Yep.
How can we find a way to help them?
Yeah. And if we'll just take that mentality period, and if you listen to last week, well, 2 weeks ago's episode at this point with Brandon Reyes, he literally says at the end of the show, like, if I had to say one thing of where the industry needed to go is that it's not about you. Like, it's not about us. Like, we're the supplement, not the show, but man, we're important. Like, we could be what helps the most important things go over the top, which is practice and games. And if we can be really good at that, that's what makes us important.
It's like Shallow says, the little things add up to be the big things.
Yep. 100%. Well, Kyle, man, I appreciate you coming on. We could talk for a lot longer if we wanted to, but we both got lives to get to. And man, I appreciate you coming on. If anybody wanted to reach out to you, where can they find you?
Yeah. On Twitter, it is at Kyle Rogers 18. No D in Rogers. So KYLERogers 18. And then on Instagram, it's at KLRogers 28.
Got it. And you mentioned earlier in the podcast about you've done some remote coaching.
Yep.
He's really unique in how he does both strength and pitching. Like he does both and it's included in that. Are you taking clients? Are you taking guys? If you're a player out there and you feel like you need some direction, or if you're just a coach and you need some direction, hey, I want to get myself in this and feel and throw or whatever it is, like how, same thing, just send you a DM and kind of inquire and set up a consultation call or what?
Yeah, I would do that. You can also go, I've got a website, rogersperformance.me. And there's some information on there. But kind of going back to what you said, like you and I both reached out to Killian. We both hired him to help us, mostly for us to learn.
Yep.
That's like one of my biggest pieces of advice to like young coaches or like aspiring coaches is like hire somebody who you can learn from.
Yeah.
Because like I'm currently training with Jordan Junta right now, which is kind of cool because it's a little bit different from Killian, but it's also kind of like a prescript level one course, like applied. Yeah. So that's kind of cool. But like I will constantly seek out people to train with who I think I can learn something from their programming or just from communicating with them. So yeah, I have a handful of coaches that I train as well remotely. But yeah, if anybody's interested in remote training, either DM me or go onto the website to get some more information there.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Kyle. We'll send you off and guys, no, thank you so much for coming on the show and we'll see you guys next week.
Yep. Appreciate you having me.